is reconvened. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good afternoon. We have our third case for today and for the April arguments. 02-2932, Nancy Magel versus Green Bay Area Visitor and Convention Bureau. Arguing for Nancy Magel is Jolene D. Schneider. Counsel?
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Jolene Schneider, and I represent Nancy Meagle. Mrs. Meagle was injured when she slipped and fell on a ketchup-soaked French fry at the Brown County Arena on February 6th of 1998. Mrs. Meagle is asking the court to reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals and remand the case for trial because the Court of Appeals improperly invaded the province of the jury. There are two main points I will cover today. First, that a reasonable jury could find that the Bureau had constructive notice of a hazardous condition because of the way in which it operated the arena. And second, the Court of Appeals improperly precluded liability prior to trial by applying public policy considerations before the jury could make a determination of negligence. As this is a review of a decision on summary judgment, the court is to give the standard of review de novo. And although this is a review of a summary judgment motion, the critical question is a question of fact, whether a reasonable jury could find that the Bureau had constructive notice of a hazardous condition.
Counsel, you mentioned that it has to do with how they ran the Brown County arena, I believe. Would it have made any difference if there had been 100 people rather than two? Is that what you're saying?
Well, certainly the inquiry to be applied is fact-specific. And under the Strack exception to the normal requirement of length of time in proving constructive notice, the court would consider several factors, one being the level of control that the business had over the facility, number two, the method of operation and whether or not that created a foreseeable danger, and three, the level of diligence that was employed to address that risk.
Well, she bought the food on the first floor and slipped on the third. Is that, or third level, is that correct?
Well, the warm food concessions were sold on the first floor in the lower east concourse. Mrs. Meagle was seated on the upper level.
Right.
Correct.
And this was, as you describe it, a ketchup-soaked French fry.
Correct.
And what I'm asking, you're talking about the operation. As I understand it, there were two people, and you know, factually there were, and that's why I asked. You're saying how they operated, in a arena like this, what effect would it have if there were 20 people? And would you be arguing if there were 20, there should be 40? Or if there were 40, there should be what level is satisfactory as far as the operation?
Certainly the level of staffing that would be required is something that the jury should decide based upon evidence of what the standard of care is for an operation like the arena. It's Mrs. Meagle's position that a reasonable jury could conclude under these facts that it was not reasonable.
And we have to get around the Strack decision.
Correct. The Strack exception is basically another way of proving constructive notice. When there is no evidence of the length of time that a hazard existed, Strack provides that if the mode of operation of a business is such that there is a foreseeable risk of danger, the jury could conclude that there was essentially notice whether or not there's any evidence of length of time.
Counselor, was there any evidence in the record that we could look at that would tell us whether there had ever been other slips and falls on food around the building?
There is nothing in the record.
Thank you.
Let's look at the mode of operation. What was the mode of operation here?
Well, the Bureau had exclusive control over the arena. It sold tickets for the show that evening, which was Pocahontas on Ice. It chose the number of tickets to sell. For this particular performance, there were 4,220 seats sold, but the arena had a capacity of a little over 5,000 for that evening. They did not allow carry-ins of food or drink into the arena. They sold concessions, and they sold the concessions for a set period of time, from 1 hour prior to the start of the show until 15 minutes before the end of the show. They staffed two janitors to patrol the facility. However, it's possible, based upon the facts in the record, that only one janitor was actually on duty the night of the accident.
I want to focus on that because it isn't clear to me. I got the impression that there was a man and a woman, and that the woman's primary task was to clean the women's restrooms.
That is the information that's in the record, correct.
And then what was the man janitor's primary task?
The man janitor's tasks were to clean the men's restrooms and also to clean the remainder of the facility in general.
I understood, and that's why I want to focus what we have here, I understood that the task was to clean the area around the concession stand. Is that correct, or is my understanding correct or incorrect?
I believe that the man was responsible for cleaning spills anywhere in the arena. However, often other employees at the arena would not summon the maintenance staff for spills. And there were no requirements imposed by the Bureau as far as making regular patrols of the area. There were no checklists. There was no requirement that the employees record or report anything about the work that was performed.
In reading the stuff, I'm sure I read it correctly, but maybe my memory is not as good. My recollection was that the male janitor cleaned the area, besides the restrooms, cleaned the area around the concession stands, and then maybe went to the Zamboni room and would be there in case there were any calls from people regarding spills. Am I wrong or right? Tell me if I'm...
You are correct. Often he would sit in the Zamboni room or in the lobby, and I think his exact quote from his deposition was to just wait for stuff to happen. Although if summoned, he would go and clean up a spill. That didn't always happen. And so the reason why this method of operation creates a foreseeable danger is because of the way in which the Bureau allowed patrons unrestricted license to take food or drink anywhere they chose in the arena.
What's the difference? And that's what I was getting at. So it's the mode of operation. So if I go to Lambeau Field in Green Bay, pick some other place, I think it seats, let's say, 60-some thousand people, probably more now, and there are literally thousands of people that are either drinking some beverage or eating a hot dog or perhaps a French fry or something else. What difference would it have made on the number of people or whether they were required to pick up something every 10 minutes? Is that what you're saying, that had to be the mode of operation?
Certainly, Mrs. Meagle is not suggesting any particular mode of operation is the correct mode of operation. That would be a question for the jury to resolve. There is not really a developed factual record at this stage in the case as to what would be a reasonable practice for either an entertainment venue such as the Brown County Arena or for other types of entertainment arenas such as perhaps Lambeau Field or Miller Park. What Lambeau Field or Miller Park does is not irrelevant to the case. It's really only relevant insofar as evidence might be presented that would go to the standard of care. The Court of Appeals really improperly precluded liability based upon fears of what might happen at Lambeau Field when this case is not really about Lambeau Field. It's about what happens.
Well, it is about this type of facility. It's about the stadium here in Madison. It's about the Brewer Stadium. It's about any large arena and what expectations one would have. And it's about whether they would serve food. So that's why I'm trying to develop this and just what could be done. And if each time we're going to have a slip and fall and then it's strict liability, and there's an expectation that they will take care of everything. That's the issue that I'm interested in.
I understand that you're concerned about strict liability. However, even if the court would remand this case and permit Mrs. Meagle to invoke the STRAC exception and present that to the jury, that does not result in strict liability. The jury would still be required to determine whether or not there was negligence and would still apportion negligence as between Mrs. Meagle and the Bureau. And so what we have is a very fact-specific inquiry that focuses on the facts of a particular case. What may be reasonable at the Brown County Arena may certainly be wholly unreasonable at Lambeau Field.
Ms. Schneider, following up on Justice Wilcox's questions, do you think it's fair when you talk about STRAC and you talk about Steinhorst to look at the nature of the business? Is that where the court should be focusing?
The nature of the business certainly plays a role. And what I think is important about cases like STRAC and Steinhorst is that they involved customers handling potentially slippery or dangerous substances. In STRAC, we had customers handling food, namely produce in the produce department, which, if fallen, can become slippery and dangerous. In the Steinhorst case, we had customers handling a shaving foam, which became slippery if that was dropped on the floor.
Okay, but you're touching on exactly what's troubling to me. In both STRAC and Steinhorst, you're talking about a relatively confined area. As you pointed out in STRAC, you're talking about the produce department and the aisle in the produce department. In Steinhorst, you're talking about a prangy department store, and you're talking about the cosmetic aisle. So in both of those instances, the court said, okay, we're going to have an exception to the actual or constructive notice requirement because of the nature of the business. But those seem to be such restricted areas in comparison with a, 61,000 square foot arena? How do you grab hold of STRAC and Steinhorst and apply them in this particular situation?
There certainly isn't any language in either STRAC or Steinhorst which would lead to the conclusion that there would not have been liability or that the exception would not have been invoked had, for example, the prune had fallen several aisles away as a customer was carrying a basket down the aisle and someone slipped and fell there. Certainly, any time a business is using a method of operation in which it should be reasonably anticipated that things could be dropped or broken, creating a hazard, and that is part of an ongoing regular method of operation where those conditions could arise on a regular basis, that creates the level of foreseeability that should then lead to the appropriate practices to counteract that risk.
Well, let me take that one step further. I'm thinking about the Kaufman case. Kaufman case is a case where, as you know, the Court of Appeals basically said, no, we're not going to apply the STRAC or Steinhorst exceptions. It's a much larger area at issue. It's a parking lot. And I just see some parallels between the large area as against the restricted or confined area. And you're still not satisfying me in that regard. How do you go from a restricted aisle, a small aisle in a grocery store, or a cosmetics aisle in a department store, to a 61,000 square foot arena?
Well, for example, the parking lot in Kaufman was actually leased to two different stores, and being an outdoor area was exposed to the elements, passerby, that sort of thing. The defendants really didn't have that sufficient level of control to be able to address any potential hazards that might come upon the parking lot. Whereas in the STRAC and the Steinhorst cases, those hazards occurred within the confines of the walls of the building and conceivably then had more control. I would submit that in this case, the Bureau had even more control over the facility, even though it is a larger facility, than even existed in the Strack or the Steinhorst cases, because the general public was not entitled to enter the building unless they had a ticket. And so they're selling tickets. They're deciding how many tickets they're going to sell. Presumably, the only way someone could have gotten in that building would have been if they had a ticket or if they worked there or were part of the performance.
So you're focusing on the idea of control.
I think control is a very important element in this case.
If you were to be arguing to a jury that the Bureau should have made this place safer, that the nature of the premises would permit it to be safer, what would you suggest? How could they have made it safer given the nature of the premises?
An example might be to have a set policy or procedure in place for even their possibly one lone janitor to patrol the aisles for debris. The concession sales concluded 15 minutes before the end of the show, which would have afforded ample opportunity for this gentleman to patrol the aisles with a little sweeper and pick up any debris that was found. Now, that would not guarantee, of course, that every piece of debris would be found, but that's not really the issue. The issue is, were there steps taken to make the place as safe as its nature would reasonably permit? That's the issue.
And that goes back to my question, because this French fry and the way your client was leaving, this is... And I know that the Court of Appeals made a policy decision, but I'm just asking, because you talk about the mode of operation, it seems very difficult to me to be able to, when 1,000 people are going downstairs, that anyone could do anything about that in as far as patrolling or picking up, because you have no idea where it was, where it originated.
And certainly that may be the case. And there isn't any evidence in the record about what the standard of care might be in that situation. Certainly a trial would perhaps bring out more facts as to the standard of care. The jury would then make a determination based upon all the facts as to whether what was done in this instance was reasonable or whether what might happen in another case involving a different venue might be reasonable.
When the Strack case was decided, Chief Justice Hallows was able to turn to precedent from other jurisdictions. I think there were at least 3 cases involving grocery stores. Do you have a precedent anywhere that would be helpful in this situation, involving an arena or a stadium or anything? I mean, some other members of the court have suggested that the setting is so much different.
The setting is certainly different than what exists in many of the reported cases throughout the country. Several states from across the country apply what is essentially the Strack exception with what they call the mode of operation rule. For example, in a case in Florida, the exception was applied in a nursing home setting where the nursing home had allowed residents who were elderly and infirm to take food from the cafeteria back to their rooms following the lunch hour. And the name of that case is Markowitz versus Helen Holmes, and that's a Florida case from 2002. What happened in that case was someone dropped some grapes on the floor and a visitor to the nursing home slipped and fell. And was injured. Nursing home is a different type of environment than a store. A plaintiff attempted to invoke the exception in a Tennessee case involving a car wash, and that attempt failed. A car wash, correct. That attempt failed simply because the facts of that case were such that it could not be reasonably anticipated that the hazard that she complained of would have existed. That case, is Martin versus Washmaster, and that's a Tennessee Court of Appeals decision from 96, where a plaintiff slipped and fell on some asphalt outside of a car wash. She claimed that some chemicals from the car wash mixed with some water and created a slippery substance, but there was ample evidence in the record that asphalt is an absorbent substance, that the area was sloped, and so this was not the type of hazard that arose on an ongoing basis. No one had any idea really where the slippery substance came from, which is really different from this case, where we know that when people carry food, particularly when many of them are children, they're likely to drop things, and steps should be taken to at least make an effort to clean that mess up. In this case, the Bureau's measures were really so deficient in that they didn't really require any patrolling of the facility whatsoever, that it really wouldn't have been likely at all that, any debris would have been found by the single lone janitor.
I'm sure there are members of the court who've been to the Brown County Arena. My recollection is that there are aisles going from the bottom to the top, all around. Suppose someone slipped not on one of those aisles going up and down, or even those areas where you walk this way, but between rows. Let's suppose I'm walking right down the row and Chief Justice dropped, you know, French fries dripping with ketchup. Would you have a different view then? I mean, would you be expecting staff to check that situation?
That would certainly present a tougher case because, again, what we're talking about here is what is reasonable under the circumstances based on the risk, and is the Bureau making the arena as safe as its nature would reasonably permit? And so I don't know whether or not that would be reasonable to patrol the individual seating areas. It may be, it may not be. The problem is we don't have any information in the record about what is the standard of care in operating a facility like this. And that's what the jury would decide if the case were remanded for trial. And the second point that I wanted to make was that the Court of Appeals really improperly precluded liability by invoking some of their public policy considerations before the jury could make a determination of negligence at trial. And Wisconsin law is quite clear that public policy should not be applied to preclude liability until the facts are presented to a jury, unless we have a very simple case where the facts are simple and the policy implications are clear. In this case, we have almost the exact opposite. Although we have historical facts about the fall that are undisputed, we don't have really a plethora of facts in the record regarding what is the standard of care in maintaining a place like the arena. And that's what a trial would bring out. And if we had that information, we could then more fully explore whatever public policy implications might arise if a jury were to, in fact, find liability. But because we don't have that in this case, it would be premature to apply public policy considerations, and we should really remand this case back.
Let me ask, refresh my recollection, was there some kind of discovery here that could have explored that standard of care?
Certainly, I suppose there could have been. However, there was not. Presumably, both sides would present information at trial about what's reasonable, what's not reasonable, and the jury could make a decision.
Would that be expert testimony?
It certainly could be expert testimony.
Is the common law negligence issue still alive? Is that still before this court? Or are you basically arguing now strictly the safe place statute?
I believe that a jury could still find common law negligence even if the jury did not find liability based upon the safe place statute. And the Dykstra case specifically noted that the safe place statute imposed a higher duty than the duty of ordinary care. The duty is to provide a place that is safe as its nature would reasonably permit, which is a higher standard than ordinary care. And so the jury could still find common law negligence even if it did not find a violation of the safe place statute.
Well, now, the Court of Appeals relied on that St. Sebastian congregation case and basically said that if you can't make it under safe place law, you can't make it under common law negligence. Do you disagree with that?
I do respectfully disagree with that for a couple of reasons. Number one, that St. Sebastian's case came down, I believe, sometime in the 1960s, whereas the Dykstra case came down much later and kind of stated the opposite. The quote from that St. Sebastian's Ballast Court decision actually said at 66 with second 427, the statutory safe place duty to construct and maintain a public building as safe as its nature will reasonably permit is not a lesser standard than that imposed by common law. So it doesn't really address whether it's the same standard.
Give us the rest of the quote. Because then they go on to say that if you can't meet that requirement, you can't meet common law negligence. Isn't that what they conclude?
They did go on to say that, but it didn't really make sense based upon the quoted language. And the court certainly later seems to have backtracked from that position in stating in cases like Dykstra clearly and unequivocally that the duty imposed under the safe place statute is a higher duty than that imposed under common law. So I would disagree.
Well, did the trial court rule on your common law doctrine, too?
Yes. The trial court determined that the Bureau was entitled to summary judgment on the common law doctrine as well.
So have you, in effect, want a reversal on both issues?
That's correct. I see that my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, and you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. William J. Ewald, representing Green Bay Area Visitor and Convention Bureau, Inc.
Good afternoon. Excuse me. May it please the court. My name is Bill Ewald, and I represent the Green Bay Area Visitor and Convention Bureau. I respectfully disagree with my colleague that this is a case that presents complicated facts. I don't think that the circumstances of the accident itself could be much more simple. Moreover, there are basic undisputed facts that tell us that this is a rather simple case. There is no actual notice to the Visitor and Convention Bureau of this particular food spill, no evidence of that. There's absolutely no length of time evidence. The accident location was at a place far removed from where the French fries and the concession stands were located, where the French fries were sold. And the arena is a large-scale entertainment venue. In this particular instance, as has been observed, 61,000 square feet, three different levels, capable of holding upwards of 5,000 spectators, more than 4,200 spectators for this particular event.
What? Now, they had two people that were in the janitorial service. Are you arguing, well, we had two and that's fine, and if we had none, that would be fine? Because, I mean, the fact you had some there, maybe that was so little that it would not make any difference. In other words, I asked your opposing counsel on, you know, what would be expected, and she talked about the mode of operation.
I appreciate that, Justice Wilcox. And therein lies the dilemma. How many are enough? Obviously, zero would not be enough. Are 100 enough? 1,000 enough? I think that becomes a highly speculative exercise given the circumstances, especially of this particular case.
Well, are two enough?
Pardon?
Are two enough?
I do believe they are enough if they're doing their work.
The 61,000 yes. Square feet?
When the spectators are in the stands and there's very little activity in the hallways on the common stairs, yes, I think two people could.
How many square feet of common stairs and how many staircases?
Your Honor, I can't tell you because that hasn't been developed in the record.
Isn't there a map or a drawing of this area?
There is, but it was simply a diagram of the seating area without dimensions, without the number of square feet in any given portion, whether we're talking about stairways, upper-level concourse,
lower-level. How many stairways?
There are four sets of stairways that are the main stairways from the main floor, the ground floor, to the upper-level concourses. But within the seating area, there are many stairways that go up and down from the vomitories that come off the second-level concourse.
Counselor, do you agree that the question under the state place statute is whether the arena was made as safe as reasonably possible?
That is the standard under the safe place statute, yes.
How can you decide that when you don't know the area, when you don't have any evidence about whether there were other slip and falls there or no other slip and falls there on food? I don't see how that's not a fact-specific issue. Can you explain to me how, as a matter of law, you have to determine they did make it as safe as reasonably possible?
I don't think the question is whether the Convention Bureau made the place as safe as reasonably possible.
Right.
I think the question is whether under the law, given this particular venue and given its mode of operation, whether or not you can apply the Strack exception to allow the case to go to a jury and then allow the jury to decide whether two people were enough or not enough.
Yeah, but I mean, that all goes to the reasonably possible part of the issue, in my view. And I think that's what the cases look at, and they have that exception from what had been the former law for the cases, the two cases that we've talked about. But it still feels so fact-specific to me. I mean, you don't know where the staircases are. Nobody knows where the janitors were at any particular time. Nobody knows where they might have been at a particular time. That's all part of how they do business, right?
It's part of how they do business after the hazardous condition develops. And I think there's a dichotomy here.
Okay.
Because what led to the unsafe condition in the first instance?
Right.
And that's obviously the sale of, of food that can be carried anywhere into the arena. What could or should have been done to inspect and discover food spills and remedy them before, before an accident, that's the second half of the question. My point is that in dealing with the first half, whether you ever are entitled under the law to get to a jury, in a safe place case, when there's no length of time evidence, you have to decide whether or not under those circumstances the Strack exception should be applied. And my point is, in that respect, that in the two cases involving the Strack exception, that we had a very unique business operation, or at least a limited business operation in the sense of a retail store in both instances, with a spill that occurred in a limited, relatively confined area, as opposed to a very large building where it would be pure speculation as to how many people would be necessary to effectively inspect and maintain that space.
Counsel, what about this? Case goes to trial. Expert witness comes. The expert witness says, yes, I'm the maintenance director for a similar facility in Illinois. And question, are two people enough? Well, in my experience, given the type of facility, given that there were 5,000 people, given the number of staircases, would have been better before, but maybe two is okay, just like you say, depending on what they do. You know, I think that's what you said, the issue. There are two enough, well, if they're doing what they, depending on what they're doing. And this guy's going to testify that if you had two, that might be enough, but as to the mode of operation, it wasn't sufficient here. He's going to testify. He's going to say that knowing that there's only four main stairways and that you're going to have 5,000 people descending upon those stairways, that it would have been reasonable to have those two employees anywhere from a half an hour to 15 minutes before the end of the program to make a sweep of the stairways, because stairways are all 5,000 people are going to come down those four. They're all going to be kind of compacted. So it would be a good idea to make sure that any foreign substance on the stairways, that's a safe mode of operation. I mean, that's what I would expect if this case went to trial. I suppose you would, too. So why shouldn't that issue go to the jury of whether or not this facility was as safe as the nature of the place would reasonably permit?
In this particular case, Justice Bradley, the motion for summary judgment was granted on the basis of a reconsideration of an earlier motion that granted in part and denied in part. The actual decision came down after the trial date, but the judge agreed to postpone the trial because of the pending decision that had to be made on the motions for reconsideration. The point is that there never were any expert witnesses identified. We were on the eve of trial when it was determined that Judge Atkinson would make the decision on the motions for reconsideration and issue that written decision. So I'm not expecting, if this case were sent back for trial, that there would be any expert testimony unless the plaintiff successfully moved for permission to name experts. Beyond that, though, I think the answer to your question is this. It's pure speculation whether or not that French fry was on the steps for 10 minutes, 15 minutes, or 2 seconds. It could easily have been dropped by another spectator, fallen out of a fold of a coat. It could have been dropped by a child taking home their container of leftover French fries and being jostled as they're going down the steps immediately in front of Mrs. Meagle. That then, even though there were expert testimony that two janitors are not enough, four might be, a half a dozen would be better, I think that still puts the jury in a position of having to speculate whether, under these circumstances, whatever number was there could have discovered this French fry and removed it before Mrs. Meagle encountered it. And the problem, as I see it, is that in applying, in effect, the Strack exception, because I think that's what this honorable court would have to do, you begin to encroach into the area of invoking the safe place statute to, in effect, guarantee or ensure the safety of patrons at large-scale venues.
Well, I think it very well may be that if you had that kind of expert testimony, and I can just hear you, and you would be saying some of the same things in terms of causation. How can you show causation? And the jury would say, yeah, how can you show causation? Plaintiff loses.
Sure.
I'm not sure this is a plaintiff's case that the plaintiff is going to win. But that's not, what we're here for. We're to see if they can get the trial.
The arena, I suspect, is one of many, many arenas in the country. There must be an association of arena managers or something. Are there any standards out there at all? For example, if you have a 5,000 people, possible maximum, that the standards would show one custodian for every 1,000 people? I mean, are there any standards out there? And even if there are, whose responsibility is that to show that there are at this stage in the proceeding?
I'm not aware of any.
Not on the internet?
Say again, please.
Not on the internet?
It might be, but we haven't approached it from that standpoint in terms of developing this case. I think it would be the plaintiff's burden to come forward to show what standards exist, if any, in terms of the operation of an arena or a stadium, and what recommendations may be out there from an association of operators of arenas and stadiums, if any such exists, and what the standards are, and whether or not the Visitor and Convention Bureau complied with those standards, and beyond which there, I suspect, voluntary standards in any event, but they might provide a measure.
Let me ask this. There are two custodians. What about ushers? I mean, if I were working as an usher at the Brown County Arena and I saw greasy French fries on a step, would I have any obligation to do something about that as an usher? Or is that in the record at all?
No. Justice Prosser, that's perhaps part of the problem here. I think I know from my own personal standpoint what that situation is, but it's not part of the record. I do know that there is some testimony in the depositions of ushers who work. There are others, not janitorial people, but there are others in the arena building during events such as this who customarily, as a matter of practice, alert janitors to certain conditions that require cleaning up. But that's not been fully developed in the record, and Justice Rogensack, that's perhaps one reason someone might determine that the case should be sent back for trial on that issue. But I still go back to my main point that before you have to make a decision as to whether there should be a trial to develop more fact information in this case, the initial question that I would urge this court to look at is, should the STRAC exception even apply to permit to this large-scale entertainment venue so that a plaintiff such as Mrs. Beagle should be entitled to a trial by jury when there is no length of time evidence and there's pure speculation as to how long this French fry may or may not have been there.
Counselor, you mentioned that this summary judgment came down on the eve of trial. Was there a scheduling order involved in the trial?
Yes, there was.
Was there a scheduling order that involved the naming of experts?
Yes, there was.
Has that time passed?
Yes.
Was there a scheduling order that involved the naming of any witnesses that would testify at trial?
My recollection is no, that Judge Atkinson does not customarily require naming of lay witnesses.
Okay, and how close to the trial date was summary judgment granted?
The summary judgment that was granted with respect to the Visitor and Convention Bureau was initially decided on two-part basis.
Two parts, I understand that.
And the first part was decided several months before trial, as I recollect, and then the motions for reconsideration were filed within the last month or so prior to trial. And at the pretrial conference, within a few days of the trial or a week, Judge Atkinson made the decision that he was going to grant the Convention Bureau's request for reconsideration as to the Safe Place Statute claim and deny the plaintiff's motion for summary judgment relative to common law negligence or vice versa, but it was in that time frame.
Okay, thank you.
So, one of the things that concerns me about the Court of Appeals opinion is the last paragraph that cites the St. Sebastian congregation case. I haven't taken the opportunity to fully develop my concern, but my concern is this. In my mind, it's axiomatic that the duty imposed under Safe Place is a higher duty than that of common law. I mean, I know both of us grew up on Boyle and Safe Place, and all that. I mean, that's a mantra. So how can this be, as they say at the end of their opinion, since we've upheld the dismissal of the safe place violation claim, we also uphold the dismissal of the negligence claim? I mean, I always thought you can bring, you can bring both. You pled both. Sometimes you can't make the safe place claim for a variety of reasons, you know. But you can still maintain your negligence claim. So what are they saying here?
Frankly, I don't know what they're saying. It seems to me a logical non-sequitur.
I apologize.
Okay. I simply don't have an answer to that question, because logic would seem to dictate that given the safe place statute imposes a higher standard of care, that if you can't get over that hurdle, nevertheless, you may be able to get over the common law negligence hurdle.
And I bet you've tried cases that pose that very problem, of that very thing, that maybe they didn't go forward on safe place, but they still went forward on common law.
And the answer is, and especially from the standpoint of plaintiff's counsel, the preference always is to be able to try on a theory of safe place because you have the language of that statute, whereas it's a much more level playing field, if I can put it that way, when the safe play statute is not at play and it's purely common law negligence.
Well, my question was going to be substantially similar, but taken from a different perspective. The question presented here, and I didn't go back and check your petition for review, but I assume that the petition review had this similar issue. Can a place of business be found to have constructive notice of a hazardous food spill absent proof of the length of time it's present? And then it goes on to some of the facts. So if the court were to say that STRAC applied, let's take that first. My assumption is that it would still go to back for a jury trial. Maybe that's wrong, but
I think that's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Then suppose the court would say STRAC doesn't apply, distinguishing STRAC. Then what happens? Is there enough? Then we would need constructive notice. We'd actual notice or constructive notice. Constructive notice can come about because of length of time, et cetera. So if the court would find STRAC doesn't apply, what happens to the case then? Is there enough here to go for a constructive notice issue for the jury, or is there enough here to do the common law negligence?
Well,
on the theory that the standard of care, namely two people in this kind of facility, is just not the correct standard of care.
Well, I don't think that the plaintiff can overcome the burden to establish constructive notice if the STRAC exception does not apply, because there's absolutely no evidence as to how long that French fry was there. So if the trial court were so to rule.
Do the concessions close? Or do they stay open after it was okay?
No, they close approximately 15 minutes before.
Okay, so.
But, all right. It's still speculation. I think it's impermissible speculation for a trier of fact to reach a conclusion that it must have been there at least 15 minutes when there's no length of time evidence.
Well, because somebody could have dropped it on their way down.
Exactly. That's exactly my point. Now, that may still leave the the common law negligence claim viable, but I think then you get into a serious question about whether or not the jury is in the realm of speculation as to whether or not there was any ability on the part of the Convention Bureau to know that French fly was there, discover it, in other words, and do something about it. It seems to me that it may trigger the invocation of the jury instruction relative to the jury not being allowed to speculate, and it might be assuming we're at the end of the plaintiff's case and the evidence goes in as expected, that there is no evidence at all about how long that French fry was there. I think there's at least a possibility at that point of successfully arguing that the case should be dismissed, because the only way the jury can conclude that the Convention Bureau was negligent is that they somehow knew it was there a sufficient length of time that they should have known and taken some steps to clean up the French fry.
You have to have time to get into that should have known. Couldn't you have the way in which the operation is conducted to get into that should have known element for common law negligence?
You may be right, Justice Rogensack. You may be right that simply presenting evidence as to the number of employees there and that if they had more employees, they would have discovered it. But I think that I still have the argument to a jury that it's pure speculation as to when the French fry was dropped and landed on the stairs and how many employees would be necessary to police it, especially under these circumstances, departing crowd.
Yeah, I can see what you're saying, because what you're really doing is getting back to time anyway.
Correct.
Because they have to have, there has to be something there that suffices for reasonable care on their part. Thank you.
There could be negligence of failing to have enough adequate staff. That may be negligent. But the issue might very well be that negligence wasn't causal.
That's
which
correct.
Which is what you and Justice Bradley discussed a few moments ago. Because even if you had everybody there, might have dropped 2 seconds before, at which point your negligence of not having staff did not cause that injury.
That's correct. And that it also brings us back full circle to the public policy consideration of how many employees does a large-scale entertainment venue operator have to have on duty in order to at least reasonably be expected to find food and beverage spills and do something to clean them up before they're encountered by spectators as they're going about the premises. And we have here the worst case scenario, because this is the end of the show and everybody's leaving at once, and if it's dropped only seconds before Mrs. Meagle encounters it, there's just no way for the operator to have an opportunity, the vigilant operator, to have an opportunity to discover and clean it up.
Mr. Ewald, is there any testimony in the record, deposition testimony or by affidavit, that would indicate when a cleaning crew comes in to clean the arena?
I think, Justice Crooks, that testimony was that after the show, when it's an afternoon matinee type show, they clean it immediately afterward. If it's a show in the evening that ends 9 or 10 o'clock at night, depending on whether the arena is going to be torn down and set up for another event, if it's not going to be torn down, if it's going to be maintained, because we're talking Friday evening and it's going to be a Saturday afternoon matinee event, then the cleaning crew would be present Saturday morning to clean it up.
Is there any indication as to how many people are involved in the cleaning crew?
I don't know that there were precise numbers developed during discovery, but there's quite a crew that works for teardown and setup and also for cleaning purposes. My recollection is it's well more than just two people that clean up.
And this was an evening performance or an
afternoon? This was an evening performance.
Thank you.
I'm not quite clear. You just mentioned discovery. How much was there full discovery here?
Yes, there was. There were depositions of, obviously, of Mrs. Meagle and her adult daughter, who was in her company that evening. There were depositions of half a dozen or more employees of the Visitor and Convention Bureau who worked in the arena. But that basically was the extent of it, Justice Prosser. There were no experts named other than medical experts, but no liability experts. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Schneider?
Thank you. There are a few points I'd like to make during my rebuttal argument. First, the jury may draw competing inferences even from undisputed facts. As this court pointed out in the Alvarado case last term, the trier of fact always needs to pass upon reasonableness, even when historical facts are concededly undisputed. And so in this case, although there really is no dispute about the factual circumstances leading up to Mrs. Neagle's fall, including the fact that there is no length of time evidence about how long the French fry was there, the evidence that would go in at trial regarding the number of staff that was employed, the measures in which that staff took to clean the building, the policies and procedures the Bureau had in place, its policies for the sale of concessions.
Counselor, given those facts, which are just historic facts, how are you going to use them to establish a standard of care when you don't have an expert that can establish a standard of care for this kind of a business? And those are just historic facts. They could be two people, they could be one person, they could be 10 people, all of which may be inadequate, but I don't see how you're going to show that without an expert that knows how these facilities are to be operated in a safe manner, or at least what's usual and customary. How are you going to manage that?
Well, certainly I think expert testimony would be helpful from both sides to develop those facts in further detail. But I think a reasonable juror could conclude that having as little as one janitor to clean a 61,000-square-foot facility with over 4,200 people in attendance is not adequate.
So you think you can do this like res ipsa loquitur? Because you only have one, it's got to be not enough?
I don't think it's tantamount to res ipsa loquitur. I think when the jury considers all the facts and circumstances of the case, including the size of the arena and the methods that were used, a jury could conclude that there was negligence.
Well, how does a jury, within its pocket of knowledge that's common to everybody, know what should have been provided? I don't see how you can get there, frankly. I think you have to have someone to establish what the standard of care is for these facilities, and it appears that time has gone by.
Well, certainly, as always, I think in some circumstances, expert testimony would be helpful to a jury in making those determinations.
Well, we don't want them to speculate. I mean, if we're just going to let them use their common old knowledge, I mean, I don't have any common old knowledge as a plain old person walking down the street about what's enough to take care of a facility like this, or what's too much, or what's too little.
We always ask jurors to make reasonableness determinations and negligence determinations based upon a set of facts.
Well, and
to do that, jurors
knowledge.
Use their life experiences. I'm sorry.
Well, it's based on common knowledge, though. And I think, you know, running a big facility like this is I don't know that it's within the common knowledge of the average person.
Well, isn't it within the common knowledge of the average person that, say, a house that has 1,500 square feet may be cleaned by one person, and you double or triple and quadruple that. But you've got a little problem about one person or two persons.
Right.
Isn't the problem whether there was one or there were 15, where the French fry was dropped at the time, which was on the stairway when maybe 1,000 people were descending, as the opposing counsel said, what difference would it have made?
And it normally would not be required for a facility such as the Bureau to find every French fry. The point of the Strack exception is that because the business practices are arguably so deficient that there was no possible way the French fry could have been located. The point of the Safe Place statute is that a vigilant business owner is going to take reasonable steps to address the foreseeable hazards, to make the place as safe as its nature would reasonably
permit. You have to find a causal connection, even under the Safe Place statute?
Certainly, there must be a causal connection.
Okay, so how do you do that here?
Because the business practices were so deficient, no one patrolled those aisles before the patrons left. The point of STRAC is that it's creating this foreseeable hazard that provides the notice. The requirement is that the arena maintain this safe place. There's no dispute that the French fry is what caused the fall. Vigilant business practices. I'm sorry, I see my time is up.
You can complete it. Your thought.
Would address that and take steps to counteract it. And that is the heart of what is deficient in this case. Thank you.
May I ask one other question?
Mr.
In attempting to assess whether the arena authorities were negligent or not, why should their effort be confined to custodians and not include, say, an usher that might, I mean, it seems to me if I were an usher and I saw something dangerous on the step, I would pick it up. I mean, why should it be confined to two people?
Well, unfortunately, Justice Prosser, there really isn't information in the record about what the job duties of the ushers were or what the Bureau expected the ushers to do, what the ushers actually did in practice, other than the testimony of Dan Goich, who was the janitor on staff the night of the fall, who said specifically that for food spills that other employees typically or may not always call him for that, that employees may just kick it off to the side and not call him. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Ms. Schneider. Thank you, Ms. Ewald, for discussing the workplace statute and common law negligence in large facilities. That ends our hearing in 02-2932, Magel versus Green Bay Area Visitor and Convention Bureau, Inc. We are in recess until we sit in Racine on this coming Tuesday.